This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Peter Onuf. During the American Revolution, George Washington had a problem. His soldiers were very thirsty.
The problem is that Washington can't provide all this alcohol that on paper the men are supposed to get. And so he makes a switch in 1781. He says, from now on, we're going to have rum.
150 years later, we were at war again. But this time, booze was the enemy.
World War I was the prohibitionist's dream, because all of a sudden, there was this great noble cause that the United States had plunged into.
America's longest-running argument, wet or dry, 18 or 21, rum or cider.
Shaken or stirred.
Today on Backstory, Cheers and Jeers, a history of alcohol in America.
First, some history in the making.
Hello, Backstory Podcasters. I'm Tony Field, senior producer of the show. If you're liking what you're hearing so far on the new and improved weekly version of Backstory, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, tell your family members, tell the people you go to work with or school with, tell them that they can find us on iTunes, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Tumblr, and of course, on the web, backstoryradio.org. That's where all of our new shows take shape every week, with input from you, our listening audience. In addition, we are always accepting financial contributions to help us cover our production costs. There's a link to give in the top right-hand corner of our website, backstoryradio.org. That's it from me. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Portions of this broadcast were originally aired in 2008.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
I'm Brian Ballow, your 20th century guy, and I'm here with Ed Ayers.
Who's your 19th century guy?
And Peter Onuf.
Your 18th century guy. And today on our show, we are going to get...
smashed.
Blitzed.
Blasted.
Soused.
Sloshed.
Plastered.
Buzzed.
Schnockered is one.
Fustigated.
Spifflicated.
Liquored up.
Crocked.
Not quite myself.
That's all? If we're going to do this, we might as well get three sheets to the wind, baby.
Three sheets to the wind.
Three sheets to the wind.
Absolutely soused.
Yes, today on our show, we're talking about one of America's very favorite pastimes, drinking. Now, it might interest you to know that our fascination with ways to describe inebriation goes back a long time, and perhaps nobody has come up with quite as many words for drunk as has Benjamin Franklin.
Addled, afflicted, bewitched, been at Barbados, cramped.
In 1776, Franklin published the Drinker's Dictionary, a kind of single-subject thesaurus with more than 200 variations on the theme.
He's quarrelsome, like a rat in trouble. He's fishy, fuddled, sore-footed, as good conditioned as a puppy. Got a brass eye, got on his little hat, in the suds.
Now, we don't have to point out that drunkenness also has a very dark side. And that also has deep roots in American history. So today on our show, we're going to figure out why America's relationship with alcohol seems so schizophrenic. On one hand, we seem all about excess. On another, all about abstinence. We're going to try to figure out how those two things relate.
Hey, Peter, you know, all those synonyms that Franklin rattled off, I mean, somebody who could come up with that many names for being drunk, he had to be awash in alcohol. How much were people drinking back in ye old times?
Well, Brian, a whole lot. It was common for everybody, men, women, even children, to start their day with a glass of hard cider. By 1770, the average white woman in Virginia was drinking a pint of the stuff each day. The average white male was drinking the equivalent of 7 shots of hard alcohol daily. I recently sat down with historian Sarah Hand Meacham, who's written about alcohol in the colonial Chesapeake, and I asked her, why did people drink so much then?
There's really nothing else to drink. The water is filled with insects, blood from killing animals. I can't think of a better way to say it.
Okay, how about milk?
Well, the cows weren't bred the way they are today. They didn't have as much milk, and cows sometimes grazed on Jimson weed, which gave people milk sickness, a serious illness.
Energy drinks, something like this. Seriously, fruit drinks. Come on.
No, there are naturally occurring airborne yeast that make any open fruit juice turn alcoholic. So there's really very little to drink other than alcohol.
So where did they get their alcohol?
They are mostly making it. And one of the surprising things, something people don't always realize, is that it was mostly women's work to make it. Back in England, where most of the colonists were coming from in this region, at least the free colonists, they were drinking ale and beer. And mm-hmm. back then, ale didn't have hops and beer did have hops, but all made from wheat. Wheat was just too much trouble to grow in the Virginia region where you could make so much profit from tobacco. And so what they do is they revert back to older ways of having women make cider.
So, sir, you're describing a culture in which everybody all the time is drinking. They're drinking in the fields. They're drinking first thing in the morning. It's not just cider. It's any old thing that
they
can
are.
Be fermented,
mm-hmm.
right? So there must have been a lot of drunkenness. It stands to reason. People are imbibing so much. So is there a drinking problem, or why don't people see a problem?
There do not seem to have been any concerns about drunkenness in the 18th century, in 18th century America. Generally speaking, people drank differently in the 18th century. Oh. They're drinking it throughout the day, so it's a little bit different, and they're mm-hmm. very accustomed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there really don't seem to have been concerns about drunkenness. It's true that they do describe people occasionally as drunk. There are court cases where somebody will be at court and the justices will throw someone out for being so drunk that he called the
right.
justices, "You rotten, vile dogs."
Just telling the truth.
Right? But they don't do anything to them. They just say, "Go sober up and come back."
Period specialists tend to think that the American Revolution changes everything. It's a new world.
And it did change everything.
Yeah. Would it be a new and more sober world, or what changed in the world of alcohol?
It was going to be a more sober world for some people.
Uh-huh.
And a less sober world for others.
Whoa.
So part of what happens during the American Revolution is that in 1781, George Washington decided to change the daily rations. Up until then, the Continental Army had gotten their supplies the same way that English armies traditionally had. They went from place to place, and the local housewives came out, they set up stalls, and they sold food and liquor to the army.
Mm-hmm.
But this creates all sorts of problems. People
right.
fall in love, people get active in other ways,
yeah.
and a lot of children were produced. And so what happens
okay.
is that George Washington gets, I think, understandably very frustrated, where he has all of these sort of women trailing along with the men. He has all these children trailing along. They're eating food that could be for the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington is trying to figure out ways to make a more professional army.
But it's not the drunkenness of the soldiers so much as their sex lives that seems to be bothering.
That's true. George Washington is not particularly concerned about their drunkenness. And in fact, Washington was incredibly concerned that soldiers were not getting enough to drink. The soldiers were supposed to get the equivalent of at least 3 shots of rum per day or a pint of cider per day.
1 pint of cider is just half of what a Chesapeake woman
That's
would have
right. It's not nearly enough for a
wow.
fighting man.
Okay.
And in fact, men fighting the American Revolution are supposed to get extra rations of alcohol if they actually fight that day, right before battle,
oh, especially.
So that they're really geared up. But if it rains, they get double rations. The problem is that Washington can't provide all this alcohol that on paper the men are supposed to get.
Uh-huh.
And so he makes a switch in 1781. He says, from now on, we're going to have rum provided on year-long contracts. So instead of having all these women set up stalls and have the men go and get their own alcohol,
yeah.
we're going to have army-supplied rum to the fighting men.
So this is a key moment.
This is a key moment
in the transition toward a more industrialized market-based alcohol.
It is, and I think
culture.
It also helps teach American men, these new creatures, right? American men,
yeah.
that American men drink distilled liquor made by other American men. It really leads to the masculinization of alcohol. But at the same time, there's another shift, which is the emphasis on tea drinking.
Mm.
And once we get the rise of tea and the availability of tea in America, and particularly sort of trickling down 1760s, 1770,
dripping.
The trickling down. Part of what happens is that finally Americans have something else to drink, right? The tea is safe. Tea has water that is boiled. It is flavored with the tea leaves. And so now people who have time to make a cup of tea have something to drink that isn't alcohol. And that's when we begin to get the inkling that there might be something wrong with drinking alcohol all the time, that there might be something wrong with being drunk.
That's Sarah Ann Meacham. She's a professor of history at Virginia Commonwealth University, and her book is called Every Home a Distillery, Alcohol, Gender, and Technology in the Colonial Chesapeake.
Guys, the story that Sarah tells us takes us through the end of the American Revolution. I'm looking at a bunch of numbers here, and they tell us at that point in 1790, the average American drank 5.8 gallons of pure alcohol per year. So, Ed, bring us into the 19th century. What happens next?
Well, you know, as robust a tradition we have of drinking in colonial America, the 19th century really takes it to a new level. It turns out that whiskey is a great thing to produce from all that corn they can grow on the new farms of the West. And that whiskey not only saturates the West, but it flows back to the East, where people are buying it in the cities and towns of the East. And as a result, we see in the very beginning of the 19th century a huge spike in drinking. And so by the 1830s, the average American is drinking 7 gallons of pure alcohol every year.
Oh, come on.
A big increase. So, yeah, that's even more than back in the late 18th century.
You know, Ed, I'm looking at this chart of alcohol consumption. It seems to bear out exactly what you're saying, at least up to the 1830s. But then there's this incredible drop-off. In 1840, alcohol consumption is less than half of what it was 10 years earlier. So, you know, yet again, I got to know what's going on.
It's the age of extremes there in the 19th century, Brian. No sooner does the market bring all this cheap whiskey into America's homes and communities than people begin to worry about what it's doing. It wreaks havoc in many ways, as you can imagine. It's not unlike really the sudden appearance of crack or, you know, other drugs that that really distort social life. When Peter was talking about people drinking cider, people talking about drinking all day long, they were really living and working together. But in the 19th century, you begin to see the gender separated, you begin to see work and leisure separated, and you begin to see a lot of binge drinking. And so women are looking at this and just distraught about what this sea of alcohol is doing to the families and communities in which they live. Fortunately, they have a new tool at their command. They're in the evangelical churches that believe that you can reform the world around you as well as prepare yourself for the world to come. People can see that the conversion experience can lead people from being drunkards to being teetotalers overnight. And they think if this works so powerfully inside the church, what might it do in society as a whole? They begin to create new reform organizations that will take that same evangelical zeal of reaching out to make new recruits from abstinence from alcohol. This is something new in the 19th century, not merely moderating your intake, but stopping altogether. Once this takes root, people see, as powerful as the churches are, and as powerful as reform organizations are, if we could enlist the state, we could have even greater progress in bringing alcohol to heel. So, in Maine, in 1851, they ban alcohol altogether. And by 1855, 12 more states have enacted similar laws. It's impossible to enforce prohibition in the 19th century. They don't really have the machinery of the state to do that. And the Civil War, as you can imagine, just disrupts all of this. The amount of suffering and the amount of alcohol, the number of men who are all together, really just kind of turns that whole impulse on its head. And a lot of laws ultimately get repealed. But the idea that the state can help people avoid the evils of booze, that sticks around.
And that, Ed, is exactly what we're going to talk about after a short break. But stick around, because we are soon going to meet the mother of all government interventions, prohibition. And I mean prohibition with a capital P.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute. Comfort Restaurant is just down the road from us over in Richmond, Virginia. They specialize in cocktails with a historic twist. And so we asked the master bartender, Matthias Hegland, to give us a taste, literally, of each of our three centuries. He started with a mixed drink from the 18th century.
So in 1740, there was a British vice admiral, Vernon, who decided that due to the drunkenness and rowdiness of his sailors, their daily rum ration should probably get mixed with a little bit of water. Now, that Vice Admiral Vernon was known for wearing a waterproof jacket made out of grogram, so his nickname was Old Grogram. And this, being his go-to drink, immediately started being known as grog, and it's a staple of the British Royal Navy from the mid-1700s. We did three parts water to one part Barbados rum, and then a little bit less than one part each of a sugar syrup and fresh squeezed lime juice. They would be slugging this all day long out on the water. So for our 19th century drink, we are going to make a classic drink, much beloved in New Orleans, where it originated, and it's called a Sazerac. Now, traditionally, you would pour in some absinthe to your cocktail glass, roll it around to coat the glass, and then dump out the extra. I hate pouring out booze. It makes me sad. So we spray it into the glass, which gets you a nice, even coating. And here's where we are going to deviate from the original recipe, which called for cognac. We are going to make ours with rye. In the 1870s and 1880s, there was a nasty little bug called phylloxera, which started attacking and really destroying all of the wine-growing regions in France. So cognac suddenly became really expensive and hard to come by. What did we do? We sort of reached for our own native spirit, rye whiskey. And this is how it is classically made today. So we have good rye whiskey, a little bit of sugar, bitters, and then over the top of the drink, we have a little bit of lemon peel. Go around the rim, and then the tradition in New Orleans is to discard that peel. So all you have in there is your lovely Sazerac cocktail. I really think it's a beautiful, simple, wonderful drink.
This is Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Today on the show, alcohol. We're looking at the distinctly American relationship to drinking and not drinking throughout our history. What, you might ask, makes booze a subject worthy for the history guys? Well, how's this for an answer?
If you had to pick the reform that Americans have taken most seriously over a longer period of time, it would have to be stopping drinking. More than civil rights, more than abolition. If you just look at the sheer number of people who took this reform seriously, this is our number one across American history.
This is Jim Marone. Several years back, he published a book called Hellfire Nation. It traces the way ideas about sin have shaped reform movements. We asked Jim to pick up the story of temperance where Ed left off, with Victorian women who got together to fight the ravages of alcohol on home life. Jim said that in the middle of the 19th century, there was another factor in play.
I think the other part of it is, remember what else is happening in the society. This is becoming an era of very high immigration. Immigrants drank. And this was a way of good – another way. There are many ways in American history. We know – we can see it today. But this was a fantastic way for people to raise themselves up above these very dubious immigrants from questionable places with poor values. This was a way of saying American values are truly special. We really are a city on a hill, and we can organize ourselves around these things that really make us good and distinguish those people in the cities.
So, Jim, you've talked about ethnicity as a divide that can emerge in debates about drinking. How about race? How does race figure in the temperance movement?
Race is the other really big one, and I think it's the most overlooked piece of this, and it takes place in the South. The great metaphor, the great trope, turn of the century, is, of course, the rape narrative. The black men rape white women. And that's why Jim Crow has to go into effect, has to go into place to control this group that's not ready for the kinds of freedoms that America affords males. Now, there was a basic problem with this, that the black people, most people knew, didn't play the part of this rapacious, fearsome black male that's such an important part of the stereotype. And the missing piece was liquor. If you read the literature coming out of the 19th century, late 19th century, South, over and over again, you see there is descriptions the black man drinks alcohol, and that makes him a fiend. In fact, there was a lot of talk about outlawing pictures of women on alcohol bottles because it was said that the black man would see the white woman on her picture and would go rape the nearest white woman. It was said that why was there so much lynching in the South in the 1890s? Alcohol. So there was this great argument that black men under the influence of alcohol, so they weren't like the black guys you knew who were really quite
differential. And they weren't worried about the lynch mob being liquored up.
No, right.
Well,
they were worried about the black man being liquored up.
They very much, very, very much. But what finally brings this to a head, the Atlanta race riot, this terrible race riot in September 1906. The Atlanta newspapers get guys all jimmied up. Some woman had been assaulted for the third time by a black guy, an unknown black assailant, probably liquored up. This is in the newspaper articles if you go back and look at them. And the claim on the sub-headline is, what's wrong with our men? Can they no longer protect Southern white women? There is a horrible race riot. Young men ran through the streets, took black men off trains, out of businesses, beat them up, killed an unknown number. The elites, the progressive elites now step in and say, you know, it's not just the black guys who drink. It's the white guys. It's the lower class whites who drink too. The Atlanta race riot pushed everybody over the top and said, we just have to forbid all alcohol in Georgia. Georgia goes first. And one after another, the southern states go dry. And they go dry in arguments about race. Right as Jim Crow goes into place between 1895 and 1905.
Let me stop you there, because almost everything that the three of us have talked about up till now is a very local story, maybe state level at the most. Yet in the early 20th century, we get a national amendment. We get national prohibition.
This is
explain to our listeners how we can get from such a historically localistic story to such a powerful use of the national government.
Isn't that a fantastic story? And you can see it happening if you watch what states go dry. First, the whole South goes dry, race. Then the West goes dry, and it's part the women's movement and part a way of distinguishing the West from those horrible immigrants in the East. But there's a number of problems. One piece is it was hard to stay dry if there were other states that were wet. So that if you, Georgia, went dry, for example, it was very hard to stop the guy up on the hill from ordering a keg of whiskey from Ohio because interstate commerce is part of the Constitution. So it was impossible to be truly dry under our Constitution. But I think all of that would not have been enough to get us, I don't think, to prohibition if one last thing hadn't fallen into place. World War One.
Yeah.
World War One was the prohibitionist's dream, because all of a sudden there was this great noble cause that the United States had plunged into. Our armies were different, remember. They were going to be the great Christian armies. There's a fascinating – if you ever want to do some fascinating reading, look at the graduation addresses in 1917 – and 1918, as the college presidents and the speakers look at the boys who are going to be the officers in the American Army. At Brown, the president turned to the audience and says the same thing they said at Harvard, Princeton, Yale. Can we do less? Can we do less than these boys that we're sending over to be a Christian army? And as one of the presidents put it, patriotism must mean prohibition. Now the forces of the Wets, who lived in the Northeast, had a huge burden. They had to not only defend drinking and immigrants, they had to say why they were resisting the great Christian army. And it was in war fervor and in the sort of fervor of being the great Christian nation that prohibition goes over the top and actually becomes the law.
Well, Jim, the caricature of prohibition, particularly during its national phase, that it was an absurd attempt of rural people to impose their values on the country, and it was a colossal failure leading to gangsters and all the crime of the Depression years and so forth, giving us a balanced view, getting beyond the black and white, as you say, how would you evaluate in a more sympathetic way the experiment with prohibition?
The media lived in the big eastern cities, and they were so sarcastic. You've described it well. I think it was one of the New York papers who would do the little trick of sending reporters to big cities and with a stopwatch and asking them to time themselves how long it took them to get out in a strange city off the train and in a saloon drinking. Right. And if basically the message was, if you couldn't do it in 10 minutes, you were an idiot. And usually it was a lot less than 10 minutes. So from that we get an image that's not false. You know, cities were awash with both alcohol and, because it was a banned substance, crime.
Yeah, yeah.
In rural America, however, this is a great reform. It's our reform, is the way rural people saw it. And they believed in this reform enormously. This was for the first time they really felt the touch of federal government as a kind of spiritual cause. People like to say that the New Deal is the father of big government. That's nonsense.
Yeah.
And the father of big government is prohibition. And it won over people in the heartland from coast to coast who really believed this was the government trying to do something really quite noble. We now believe that we got back to the rate of drinking that existed in America in 1915, really before World War I begins. We got back to that rate of drinking in 1971. So in that sense, people would say, yeah, not only was prohibition successful in stopping people from drinking, people actually found it pretty good. It's a tale of two Americas, as so many stories are, isn't it?
But, Jim, taking the long view, we certainly drink a lot less than Americans did during the early Republic. And you could say that prohibition initiated a period of concern about public health in the broadest sense of the term. And the changes have been enduring ones.
And that the national government remained quite active in those issues from that point on.
Well, all those things you just said are absolutely right on. And to add to Brian's last point, one thing that was very interesting during all this was that we had to decide what the Constitution said about the federal government going in there and getting this involved in people's lives. Fourth Amendment law. Fourth Amendment says that people have to be – must be secure in their personal property and themselves. That the government cannot search and seize, and seizure. Fourth Amendment law gets rewritten around prohibition. May you wiretap someone's house? Is that the same thing as breaking in and rifling through their papers?
Right.
You see a known bootlegger driving back to Detroit from Windsor, Ontario. You're a cop. You turn around, you give chase, you stop him, you rip his seats out. What's there? Of course, cases of booze. Well, was that a legal stop or not? Cars were relatively new. So all the rules and regulations that we now use in our drug wars went into effect during prohibition. So the echo of prohibition lives on.
Yeah, for better or worse. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Brian and Peter, lots of fun. And thank you for having me on.
That's Jim Marrone. He's a political science professor at Brown University. You can listen to a longer version of our conversation on our website, backstoryradio.org.
Bad, bad whiskey. Bad, bad whiskey. Bad, bad whiskey. Made me lose my happy home. When I left home this morning, promise I would think to stay real straight and sober. I swore I wouldn't drink.
White Clay, Nebraska has a population of 14 people and sells an average of 13,000 cans of beer a day. It's a two-hour drive from the nearest city, but it's just a two-minute walk from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. The Oglala Sioux tribe has banned alcohol from Pine Ridge, where the vast majority of families struggle with alcoholism. But there's no prohibition on walking across the border to one of White Clay's four liquor stores.
Earlier this year, the tribe sued White Clay's liquor stores and several major brewing companies, accusing them of encouraging criminal drinking by selling alcohol to people who have no legal place to consume it.
Now, the story of an Indian community resisting the pressures of the alcohol trade has deep roots. Those roots go all the way back to the end of the 16th century. That's when British colonists decided that the best way to make Indians into good colonial subjects was to, as strange as it seems, sell them alcohol. Now, on face value, this is a pretty strange idea. So I sat down with Peter Mankell, a historian at the University of Southern California, to try to figure out what those early British colonists could possibly have been thinking.
So there are a number of things that they want from native peoples. I mean, they want them to convert to Christianity, and they want to sell them things and buy things. But I mean, but they really emphasize time and again that one of the things that's wrong with native peoples is they have this sort of collectivist ethos, you know, that they're not sort of, you know, individual market-oriented people. And so how do you make them market-oriented? And the answer they came to is, well, we have to sell them goods that they will want. And in some sense, the two ideal commodities to introduce into Indian country were gunpowder and alcohol. And they were ideal because as long as natives did not make them themselves, they would continually come back to colonists to buy them. And in that act of coming back to colonists, in addition to generating profits for the sellers, they are also then beginning to participate in the kinds of market behavior that was one of the core pillars of civilization. There's this moment when Sir William Johnson, who's the superintendent of Indian Affairs for the Northern Colonies, a guy who lives out in Mohawk country, who really knows, you know, as much about native peoples as any colonist, you know, when sort of writing about should we get rid of the alcohol trade, that's writing to British officials, should we get rid of it? You know, he's sort of torn because he sees the devastations of it. And at the same time, he says, well, basically, if we stop selling Indians alcohol, then what are we going to sell them? Because they really don't need that many shirts or that many pairs of leggings or that many coats. And so if we don't have alcohol to sell them, it will reduce the incentive for them to participate in the larger market economy. And then in his words, they'll become indolent. That is, they'll become lazy. And that will be an impediment to their larger mission of civilization.
So what could go possibly wrong with selling people alcohol and gunpowder, right?
Well, then you got right to the punchline there. Exactly. What could possibly go wrong?
You can probably guess what went wrong. Alcohol fueled violence in Indian country, violence that mostly hurt other Indians. It impoverished tribes who traded their goods for rum rather than for tools or clothing, and it bolstered white stereotypes of Indians as drunken, undisciplined savages. Now, not all white colonists were in favor of the alcohol trade. Some local officials worried that it would make Indians more violent in general. A lot of missionaries urged colonial authorities to ban it altogether. Indian converts to Christianity supported these efforts, but Peter Mankell told me that the most effective push for Indian temperance came from indigenous revival movements.
Really, starting in the 18th century, a number of native religious leaders came to really question the long-term relations that native peoples were having with European colonists. And by the time we get to the mid-18th century, some of those leaders, like the Delaware prophet Neolin, had really begun to articulate a sense that life had really deteriorated for native people since colonization, and they had to move towards a new relationship with each other, a new relationship with the world of the spirits.
Right.
And so we begin to see these nativist movements in which religious leaders are instructing members of their communities to sort of put to the side everything that colonists had brought them. Get rid of domesticated livestock. Let's go back to, if we're going to eat meat, let's get it from the hunt. Get rid of European-style clothing. Get rid of anything about Europeans. Get rid of, in fact, Christianity.
Wow.
And then also get rid of alcohol.
Hmm. So alcohol is embedded in this larger...
Alcohol is embedded in this larger effort to sort of reclaim their universe.
So what did whites think of this? Did they support these movements? Did they think it was still going to take state action or some religious action by white Americans, or did they applaud this?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because you would think that Euro-Americans who see the consequences of destructive drinking would embrace these sort of nativist movements, would say anything that can diminish the sales of alcohol among Indians is a good thing. But European Americans for a long time were very suspicious of native revivalist moments, movements and moments. We see that most dramatically, you know, on the Northern Plains at the end of the 19th century with the United States government response to the Ghost Dance. I mean, the Ghost Dance is a religious revival movement in which people prayed for a world in which the influences of Europeans would disappear and the ancestors would come back and harmony would reign. And then through a series of destructive pathological misunderstandings, the United States government decides that it is going to crack down on this religious observance and attack them. And so I think in some sense, from the colonial period into the 19th century, and then you could have a debate, I suppose, about the 20th century, Euro-Americans have never been especially comfortable with Native American religious movements, even though sometimes those movements, the Native movements, have the same ends, temperance, as the Euro-American movements.
That was Peter Mankel, professor of history at the University of Southern California. His book is called Deadly Medicine, Indians and Alcohol in Early America.
It's time for a short break. When we get back, we'll go to the phones.
If you'd like to be a caller on an upcoming show, have a look at our website to see the topics we're working on. That's at backstoryradio.org. We'll be right back. Guys, let's go back to Comfort Restaurant in Richmond for just one more drink recipe with Matthias Hegland.
Since we just did one New Orleans drink, we should jump to another New Orleans drink, but almost a full century later. This is the Vieux Carré, which I make here with 3/4 ounce of wild turkey rye, 3/4 ounce of sweet vermouth, good sweet vermouth, 3/4 ounce of, we're using Mukau cognac, and a 1/2 ounce of Benedictine, and then 3 heavy dashes each of Angostura and Peychaud's bitters. Stirred with ice. I like to serve mine on the rocks, so it's strained onto fresh ice. And a twist of lemon over the top. Prohibition killed off many distilleries, made many things very hard to get. And then especially after the 1950s and 1960s, people really stopped drinking some of these more complex things. They started reaching for vodka in the 70s, mass-produced sour mixes, really unfortunate things like that. But there's a whole cocktail renaissance that has been happening for probably 20 years now, and fortunately these things are starting to come back.
We're back with Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, the 18th Century History Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow. I'm the 20th century guy. Today on our show, how Americans' relationship with alcohol has changed over the course of our history.
Many of you have left comments on this topic on Facebook and our website. We've invited a few of those people to join us on air. We got a call from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we've got Patty on the line. Patty!
Yes, sir.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're talking about alcohol.
Well, it's a favorite topic of the Irish.
It sounds Irish, doesn't it? Paddy.
With 2 D's.
Yeah.
I am 4th-generation Irish in America.
Uh-huh.
But I married a man of Irish extraction. And I was interested to see, since he's from the East Coast, the persistence of alcohol in Irish-American culture.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it's famous in Irish culture.
Right.
But it's part of Irish-American culture as well.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much that had to do with the rejection of immigrants in the 19th century when the, you know, the teetotal programs were just getting started, and then in come all these immigrants have drink as part of their culture, deeply woven into the literature, the music, the jokes.
Yeah, so, Patty, you're suggesting in a way that Irish people in America have used alcohol as a form of cultural expression, sort of snubbing their noses at those waspy Yankees, those disapproving teetotaler types.
Yeah, they were pretty unashamedly drinkers.
Patty, I can't answer your question directly about the Irish, but it is clear that some of these WASP elites embraced temperance and embraced prohibition as a way of distinguishing themselves from immigrant groups, including the Irish. So I think you have a really interesting thesis that even after the Irish became acculturated, they hung on to some of the cultural meanings in terms of distinguishing themselves from the so-called enemy.
But there's also the phenomenon of the lace curtain Irish, as they're called.
Right.
That is the very hyper-respectable Irish, out-Yankee the Yankee in terms of their sobriety and so forth.
That's my husband's family.
Yeah. Boring!
But alcoholism does run along with the charm and the talk.
You have conflicted feelings about it, is what you're saying right now. That is, it's been a problem for Irish people.
It's known as the Irish curse. In my family, in my husband's family, in my in-laws' families, every family has at least one alcoholic. My parents, actually, they were not alcoholic, and they never had a drinking problem. But there had been alcoholics in both sides of their families.
Right.
So they raised us with the AA Blue Book. I mean, they brought it in the house when I was 10, and they explained to us, etc. But it's still part of the culture.
But, you know, Patty, I want to comment on something that is reflected in your call itself, which is because your name is Patty and because you're an Irish American, you can talk very openly about certain things that in the mouths of others would be seen as stereotypes. And I think there's a bit of an answer to your question in this observation, which is whether or not the Irish drink more or not, the Irish themselves are able to talk about this openly in ways that certainly would give the impression that Irish drink more, whether you happen to be right or not.
You know, when we were in Ireland a couple of years ago, I noticed the emphasis on a lot of billboards and radio shows about drunken driving. And the newspapers were actually filled with a very frank discussion of just what you're talking about, that, you know, this is so identified with the rite of passage that it really has become, they were saying in their editorials, you know, pathological for Ireland. And the drunken driving part seemed to be sort of a crisis proportion. So, you know, I think that it's a fine line for lots of different cultures, things that are identifiable as the core of the culture and set them apart, which everybody's looking for. Something that distinguishes them can also become the thing that stereotypes them. And it's always a struggle, I think.
I've read recently that the number of pubs in Ireland has declined by about 50%, that pubs are closing down, and that the old ways of drinking, the folk ways in which alcohol was a normal part of village culture and village celebrations, I mean, Irish people are becoming modern people, just as Irish American people became modern long before the Irish people did.
That true, is, but they retained the drink as part of the culture, whether you drank it at a pub or drank it at home or at your friends' homes.
Right.
They retained the alcohol.
Well, I think we've all retained the alcohol to some extent. Well, some of us can't retain it. It's a challenge.
Well, the Irish are very good at it.
Well, some of them are. So, Patty, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Patty.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Another call, and this one is from Albany, New York. We've got Joy. Joy, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I'd like to talk a little bit about the dichotomy between how we expect our teens to behave in terms of their alcohol consumption and what we allow for ourselves, and whether or not it's really fair to expect more of our teens than the behavior we actually model for them.
Whoa, that's a heavy question. So we're
May I ask how old you are, Joy?
I'm 24.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we've got a minimum age here.
Yeah, you're practically a teenager as far as we're concerned. So you're talking about double standards.
Yes, I think that we expect our teens to be moderate alcohol consumers and not drink and drive.
Yeah.
And we as adults don't necessarily model that behavior. And when an adult does get caught drinking and driving, there's no guarantee that there will be an actual punishment.
Well, I guess my answer would be, it seems that Joy is getting at the hypocrisy that surrounds adult drinking. And without sounding like a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, as the father of three teenage kids, I would You know, the higher the drinking age, the better, as far as I'm concerned. But I do agree with Joy that there's a lot of hypocrisy entailed in the way we treat adult drinkers, especially those who drive. And I, for one, would really like to see the police enforce this more seriously. And the courts, of course, often have their hands tied on this for some reason, which I can't figure out.
Guys, let's do some history here. This is the backstory, right? What about drinking ages through history? And the whole notion of Joy's question is about how we manage teenage drinking. When does that become a problem? When do adults begin worrying about teenagers acting out and link it to alcohol consumption?
Are you asking me or are you asking someone else?
I'm asking them. They're supposed to know something.
Yeah.
But but maybe you know.
Yeah.
Like, my understanding is that youth alcohol use really wasn't an issue until the 20th century and really actually the post-World War II period.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it just, first of all, in terms of the 19th century, children and teens were seen as the victims of parental alcohol abuse, particularly paternal alcohol abuse.
Good point.
No, I think that's right. I mean, in some ways, the problem of teenage drinking begins when we have teenagers, which is also a 20th century invention. You know, before that, just a gradation between children and adults. And when they became a distinct category, sharply defined, then it was looked like a problem to be solved.
Right.
And why it's a 20th century issue, number one, I think, is the car and the combination of drinking and driving and the inherent necessity of state regulation, certainly of cars. And the state had regulated alcohol for a long time, but not necessarily in regard to kids. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it's after World War II and especially the 1960s that large corporations start targeting kids for major marketing campaigns. And they do that because for the first time, kids, middle-class kids, begin to have a lot of spare change. They can get their hands on this alcohol pretty easily.
And I think getting back to Ed's point about the invention of the teen years, there's a tremendous discrepancy now between arriving at an age in which you're capable of driving cars and going to parties and drinking a lot and being responsible, because we've protracted adolescence well into the 20s, if not the 30s, for our kids. I'm not calling you, Joy. You're not an adolescent still, are you? No.
Yeah, but it's a really interesting thing, because I look at my peers sometimes that are still drunk dialing, and I'm like, you're 24.
Yeah. Yes, and that's the real problem is how do you define a precise age at which it makes sense to, in effect, license a whole population to go out and have a good time?
Well, we can legislate that people can be drafted and that they can vote.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny that you can go off and die, but you can't have a drink.
I agree.
You know, maybe age is not the right way to do this. There's certainly lots of ways to predict who is going to be a responsible drinker.
What, DNA testing or what?
No, not DNA testing. The insurance companies know all of this. They know about differences between men and women. They know about differences between people based on their grade point average. Those might end up being
like profiling.
Those might end up being much better predictors than age. But Peter, I think you really put your finger on it. Age seems neutral. We're not picking on, you know, male athletes with GPAs below 2.0, for instance. On the other hand, to address Joy's very real issue, you know, why discriminate against the responsible 20-year-old may not make sense in this day and age.
Okay, Joy. Well, we wish you joy.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Great. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you're just joining us, this is Backstory. We're talking today about the role of alcohol in American history.
We got a call from William in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. William, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask you about the brewing topic, specifically the small craft brewing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're aware of any history associated with that and where you see the future of the small craft and microbrewery, where it's going. You think it's a fad?
William, I'll just pass it to Brian, but first just say that if craft brew takes off, it's a return to the good old days.
Yeah, Peter, everybody was a craft brewer in your day.
Well, that's right.
I'm surprised you're passing it along so quickly.
It was in-house.
But before we skip over to Brian, I think I need to talk about the golden age of when we destroyed that in the 19th century, in the 20th century, with mass production.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what began in the 19th century with really being able to produce large amounts and ship, and when you had ice and standardization and being able to have water supplies that are consistent and be able to get all the raw materials by train and so forth. That begins in the 19th century, really accelerates in the 20th century, and almost comes to like an extreme form after World War II. Is that right? Before it comes back into craft?
That's right. It's really during the Great Depression and then increasing during the war, World War II, that a lot of the regional brewers are wiped out. The major development there, William, is Prohibition. And then, of course, there's a Great Depression. And a lot of those regional and smaller brewers, they didn't call them craft brewers there. They're just brewers for the local area. They just didn't make it through those 13 years of Prohibition and then long economic downturn afterwards. So what we have after World War II is really national brewers and national distribution. They start using throwaway cans. They start putting chemicals in beer and packaging it in a way that it no longer has to be shipped on ice. And this is part of the story of, a national market, national advertising. Everything's going great. We got Anheuser-Busch. We've got Miller. And then something happens in the 60s and the 70s, and that is the counterculture. It's a return to the local. And along with that, we have brewers who I guess you would label as craft brewers begin to emerge with a real critique of these large, national, standardized breweries.
Yeah. You know what's really driving this, Brian, is the new inequality and that people can afford to pay twice as much for a craft brew. Okay, William, so what's your stake in all this aside from the stake of a consumer in drinking good beer?
Well, I'm originally from Michigan. Uh-huh. Now live in Pennsylvania. And I graduated from Western Michigan University. Right. And there was a brewery near my apartment which served as my study hall also, I guess you could say. But we could only get, when I was going through college, that local brewery, that small craft beer in that area. And now I'm starting to notice some of that beer is being marketed here in eastern Pennsylvania.
You mean your Michigan beer is showing up in Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Which is fine with me. I'm not complaining.
Uh-huh.
But I've heard it brought up before, though, that how big is too big to consider it still a small craft before it starts going mainstream and then becomes another, you can get that anywhere.
You know, it is going mainstream, and all these micro breweries have been bought up. They continue to brew. They continue to do it the way they do it, but they're now owned by Budweiser or some other
company. Oh, not all of them.
Not all of them, but it's
because those hippies in the 70s who wanted the local and the authentic and hated that standardized Anheuser-Busch, those big American corporations. Well, guess what? Those big American corporations are now owned by foreign companies.
Right.
Anheuser-Busch is
so now they're exotic again.
Exactly. Well, not so much. They are gargantuan.
Now we're drinking Dutch beer.
All right. So here's
South African
beer.
Here's
a test, guys. What beer company owned by American ownership accounts for the largest percentage of the market?
Mm-hmm. I know that Old Milwaukee was voted best tasting beer not too long ago, but I don't have a clue.
William, you're changing the topic. And Old Milwaukee, by the way, is not owned by an American company
as far as I know.
That's South Africa. That's part of the Miller constellation, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Rolling Rock.
That's not a bad guess. It's Yingling.
Okay, right here,
right there, in Pennsylvania.
Right near you. Exactly. And it just surpassed Sam Adams, the Boston Brewing Company. But what's amazing is those count for tiny percentages of the market. I think less than 2% in each case. So, you know, on the one hand, we have a real move towards the microbreweries. On the other hand, most Americans, and most Americans who consider themselves to be real Americans, are drinking beer that is owned or produced by owners in other countries.
So, Brian and Ed, what interests me about all this is the Airsat's use of the word craft. It's something like organic. Craft.
Natural.
As in, the potato chips I eat are often handcrafted, and I have this image of little people making each chip for me.
So you don't mean craft is in processed cheese.
Well, I think it's the kind of nostalgia invoking Ed Century and before. My
Pepperidge
Century
Farm.
Too.
Ye oldie.
Yeah.
With an E.
Yeah. Hey, thanks a lot, William, for your great call.
Hey, enjoy your ales and stouts and have a grand day.
All right.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye now.
It's closing time here at Backstory, but we hope you'll look for us on our website or Facebook or Twitter to continue the conversation.
At BackstoryRadio.org, we've also posted video of a live version of this show that we performed this year in Milwaukee.
That's at BackstoryRadio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Jess Engelbretson, Eric Mennel, Nell Bechtenstein, and Anna Pinker. Our senior producer is Tony Field.
Jamal Milner is our technical director, and Frank Cirillo is our intern. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Wyndham.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, Weinstein Properties, the University of Virginia, an anonymous donor, and the History Channel, history made every day.
Peter Onuf and Brian Ballow are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Wyndham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.